Welcome to Book Waves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Cheryl Strayed, whose latest book is a memoir, Wild, From Lost to Found on the Pacific Crest Trail. She's also the author of a novel, Torch. She writes the Dear Sugar advice column in the Rumpus.net, has an MFA in fiction writing from Syracuse University, and is a founding member of VIDA, V-I-D-A, Women in Literary Arts, which we'll talk about somewhere down the line. But first, we'll talk, of course, about this book, Wild, which has been getting a lot of press of late. Wild is the story of a hike you took along the Pacific Crest Trail in 1995 when you were, what, 26 years old?
26.
26, 4 years after your mother died of cancer at the age of 45. And now we're 17 years later, and the book is coming out. I understand that you began Wild as one of a series of personal essays that was supposed to be in a book of personal essays that you were considering writing. Is that correct?
That's right. I'd actually written several personal essays, and it was sort of my idea to get a quick book out there. And I had looked at those essays and thought, you know, they sort of loosely told the story of my childhood in my 20s. And the piece that was missing was the story of that hike. So I began to write it. Insanely, I thought that I could somehow write about this whole hike in 20 pages or so. I quickly learned that was wrong. So Wild was born.
You were 50 pages into it and you hadn't even gotten to the hike yet.
Yeah, right? Yeah, exactly. And then I was 90 pages in and hadn't gotten to the hike. And then, you know, pretty soon I realized, okay, this is a big story of not only the hike, of what brought me to the hike. Once I conceived it as a book, I tried to tell both of those stories.
The novel Torch tells in fictionalized form some of the story that we hear about here, which is of your mother, her death, and its effect on you. So in essence, you kept going back to the same story again.
I did. In Torch, it does have these autobiographical strokes. There is a young woman who dies of cancer pretty much exactly like my mom died in Torch. And there is, you know, a daughter who grieves her mother's loss. But I also, in Torch, you know, I do tell a very fictional story about a family in their grief in the year after this young mother dies. And it is a story that didn't let me go. I think that Torch is much more fictional than a lot of people actually think, because they do see that kind of echo in my own life. But what I found when I was writing Wild is, yes, I had to tell the story of my mother's death all over again. It really became this thing. I think a lot of writers, they get these obsessions, and it is, for better or worse, it was the story that rose to the page.
Do you feel now, after it's written, that you need to keep going back to it again, or do you think on some level you've finally pulled what you need to get out of it?
I do think that I've probably pulled what I need to get out of it for this time of my life, but I wouldn't be surprised at all if I revisit it in some way over time in my future books. I have another book coming out in July. It's a collection of my Dear Sugar columns called Tiny Beautiful Things. And in those advice columns, I often tell stories of my own life. And there are some stories about my mom and about my grief in that book, too. I'm working on another book, a novel, and it isn't about a dead mother, and it isn't about my dead mother. But who knows? You know, I wouldn't say, maybe I'll be 70 and I'll suddenly write another novel about grief, or a memoir that tells that story.
How conscious is that writing at that point? I mean, when you're working on this new novel, does it just consciously hit you, oh, I'm going to add a young mother who died, or how does that work for you?
I write very intuitively. I really begin with an image or an idea or some sort of impulse to tell, dig into a particular truth. And what happens is I'm telling the story that things emerge. Interestingly, when I first started writing Wild, I went around saying, finally, I'm writing something that's not about my mom and my grief, which is hilarious now in retrospect, because it's so much about that. I really thought, okay, I'm going to keep it focused on the hike, and, you know, I'll write a little bit about my mom, but she's not going to be a major thread, and of course she is. And so I really believe, I always, when I teach writing, I always tell my students, you absolutely have to give way to that inner voice, that obsession, the story that must be told. And we see that over and over in many of our greatest writers. They've written to similar themes, to similar circumstances repeatedly throughout their long careers.
Well, Cheryl Strayed, getting to the book itself, okay, you began writing this as an essay and it began getting bigger and bigger and bigger. At what point did you say, I know you went to your writing class and they said, hey, this is a book, this
right.
is a book. But at what point did you realize that in order to do this correctly, you were going to have to do a lot of research, kind of go from beyond your memory into the actual places and events?
Well, I had kept a journal. All through my 20s and 30s, I was an avid journal keeper. So luckily, I had that journal of my hike. And because I was out there on the trail by myself, I didn't have those distractions. I really would write pages and pages each day chronicling what happened, what was going on for me inside, as well as, you know, what the landscape looked like. So I use that a lot in my book. I also tried to get in touch with some of the people I met on the trail. The internet allows you to find people these days. But what was funny is several of the people I met have common enough names that I couldn't find them and didn't ever find them. But I did find some of the people and had stayed in touch with a few others. And I would email them and say, what do you remember of the time we spent together on the trail? You know, just leaving that question open-ended so they could tell me. And what was really interesting is so often what they would write back to me, what they remembered was very much what I remembered as well. And then, of course, just researching the trail itself, rereading those guidebooks that I carried with me that summer, really reaching to accurately portray the landscape and the plant life and the animal life. You know, I did some research for Wild, but most of it was also really a very internal mining of my own sense of what I did and what it meant. Because I think that memoir, you know, it isn't just what happened. It's what experience or what meaning does the writer bring to bear on that experience. So that was the work I did.
One of the aspects of what takes a book to another level is almost a cinematic approach. Did you go on hikes back to those parts of the Pacific Crest Trail?
I did do some hikes on the Pacific Crest Trail, but I certainly couldn't go to many places. I hiked some of the Oregon PCT, and sometimes I would just go out into the wilderness itself, you know, didn't have to be on the PCT, to get that feeling again. It's amazing to me how quickly you do get it. You know, put a pack on your back and start walking, and about 20 minutes in, you realize you're out there. And that was really helpful because I wanted to create a visceral sense of the world, a vivid sense of that landscape.
Well, one thing that you would never do again, I guess, is wear boots that were too tight or put a pack on your back that big men with muscles couldn't lift.
Exactly. I couldn't lift my pack. I literally could not lift my pack the day I began my hike. And the irony is that I had to carry it over 1,100 miles of rugged terrain. And therein lies the paradox, really, of the journey.
Cheryl Strayed, the construction of the book, and I want to get into some of the details, but first, the construction of the book, I noticed as I was reading it, you were able, maybe consciously, maybe instinctively, to take us from the hike to a memory and then back to the hike, back and forth, back and forth. And as I was reading it, I'm going, wow, this thing is really constructed almost like a building. And how conscious was that construction?
Thank you. I think it's a result of two things. Years of being a writer. I'm 43. I've been a serious writer since I was 19. I've wanted to be a writer since I could write at 6 or 7. And so I think, you know, I've read enough and studied enough and worked enough that some of that, you know, it was a muscle I developed. And then some of it was conscious. I did know that I had a big backstory to tell, and I also had a big front story to tell that I wanted to keep the reader very vividly on that the forward motion of the hike. And so early on, I knew that each chapter had to begin on the trail. Each chapter brought the reader physically further on the trail into the story. What I found then when I was doing that, by you know, sticking to that sort of rule of every chapter opens on the trail, what I would be naturally led to then at different points in the story was a sort of spiraling backwards. So the trail is told chronologically. My backstory is told out of order. There's intuition again. You know, when I reached a certain point, you know, when I'm hiking in the snow, for example, sort of midway in the book, and I get out of the snow, I've just come through this incredibly intense time, and that's the time that I tell you what I think of as the most intense and harrowing story in the book, and that is the story of my mother's horse. And so that's an example where I felt that the readers, through the journey, I had prepared the readers for that moment. And that's when I could tell that story.
Was that story added later, or was that always in the manuscript?
Well, when I first sold the book, I sold it based on the first 130 pages to Knopf. And in that proposal, it was 130 pages and then a synopsis of what would follow. And I didn't include that story in the synopsis because it didn't then occur to me that I would tell it. once I got deeper into the book and kept writing, and like I say, you know, once I was really writing that passage where here I was on the trail that was covered with snow, I couldn't even see that I was actually on the trail. I was going across the snow in the wilderness using map and compass. When I reached that place in the narrative, something in my heart just opened up, and I knew that I had to tell that story.
Cheryl Strayed, in telling the story of your life before the trail, you delve into areas where you're revealing a lot of things about yourself, and I wonder, could you have actually done it this way if you hadn't already sort of come out by saying you were the author of the Dear Sugar columns, where you'd already revealed stuff about yourself, so that it was less of a threat, in a sense, to have everything come out of the woodwork?
I would say that people who have read me from the beginning, the essays I published in various magazines over the years, and then Torch, and then people who read the Dear Sugar column, the hallmark of my writing is that openness, is that sort of emotional bravery, if you will. And what I have to say about that is I honestly think that it would be harder to write from a closed-off position. I think that a writer's job is to reveal. Revelation is what we're here for. If you're just going to stand around, you know, talking about, you know, the curtains or the weather, you know, why bother? And so it's not that it doesn't scare me. I absolutely do feel a lot of times when I have written a scene in which I really have sort of bared my soul or confessed my mistakes or really admitted to some of the hardest things about me, I definitely feel afraid that people will condemn me or that people will judge me or that people will even just know me in a way that I don't usually walk down the street wanting people to know me, right? And yet, that's the writer's job. That's the writer's work. And what's fascinating to me is everything that I fear that people will condemn me for is actually the thing that people love me the most for. I cannot tell you how few letters and emails I've gotten over the years where somebody said something nasty to me about something I wrote versus somebody who wrote and said thank you because they recognized themselves in me and they were inspired by the fact that I dared to say it.
You were a fairly loathsome person in that period, and I'm not saying that in any judgment, in that period between after your mother died and when you went on the hike, what you did to your ex-husband,
right.
The drugs, the way you lied to people, all of that. I mean, it's pretty scary to actually say, hey, I was pretty awful at the time.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And I mean, I think you're referring to, I cheated on my ex-husband who was a good man who I loved and he loved me. And I deceived him and committed infidelities and then got involved in heroin. And yeah, I was having a hard time. And I was doing the best I could do, and it wasn't very well.
And obviously, you needed to do something else. So you went on this hike, which must have flabbergasted everybody, because you walk into a store in Minneapolis, you see something about a booklet about the Pacific Crest Trail, which I had never heard of, and I've been living in California a long time, which runs up along the Sierras from the Mexican border, I guess all the way up to Canada. That you went as far north as the border of Oregon and Washington.
That's right.
And you just decided to just do this without any backpacking experience, just reading books.
That's right. Well, and in fairness, you know, I had grown up in the wilderness of northern Minnesota. I'd grown up without electricity and running water, indoor plumbing for my teen years. So I was used to roughing it. And I also, the wilderness was home to me. And after my mother died, my family fell apart. My stepfather really wasn't able to kind of sustain himself really as our father, as he had been to me. And so suddenly I didn't have a home. And I think in retrospect, what I see is my decision to hike the PCT was a search for home. And I knew, even though I too had never heard of the Pacific Crest Trail until I picked up that guidebook, I knew that I would find my best self there, that I would gather myself. And you know, one thing I want to say, you know, I was absolutely in the lowest moment of my life, but I was still me. And, you know, one of the things that was really important to me in writing Wild that I didn't want it to seem as if, you know, I'm this messed up, terrible person and I hike this trail and then nature makes me okay and then I'm the Buddha, you know, because that's not how transformation works. Many of the people in my life who knew me during that time, my friends, they knew me as a good person and they saw that I had done something that was so much against, you know, who I really was and against my values. And, you know, so I was a whole person who was failing. And I was failing in a way that I felt really disgraced my mother ultimately. And that's why I couldn't bear it. I knew I had to become the person my mother raised. And so when I saw that guidebook, there was something, it was a far off land, but it was also, I recognized it. And I felt it in my gut that I had to go there.
You're listening to an interview with Cheryl Strayed, whose book is titled Wild, From Lost to Found on the Pacific Coast Trail. Cheryl Strayed, single woman, attractive single woman in her mid-20s, alone on a trail, with shoes that don't fit and a backpack that's too big. She never leaves quite enough money to survive, which is, I mean, torture. All of this, and what I kept thinking is, you know, what it is really is going outside your own comfort and safety zone and seeing what you could do.
It is. And I think to some extent, too, you know, you mentioned money. I grew up poor, and I don't think that I would have been able to take this trip with the amount of money I did had I not had that experience, because I spent most of my childhood outside that comfort zone. You know, my family was often not comfortable, and it was because of money. And what I learned, you know, the upside of growing up that way, and there are many, is that you get to see how to survive. You get to see how to make it. You get to see that you can make it and that money is only one of the things we need. And so, you know, if I had been somebody who'd been raised in a different kind of family that had more money, I would have maybe said, oh, you know, I don't have enough money to go on this trip, and I wouldn't have done it. Or if I had believed the narrative that we're told about women, that young women shouldn't go alone into the woods or go anywhere, really, you know, I would have not been able to do it. And so what I decided to do is to believe a different story than we're told about women, and I just was going to be okay out there. And so I repeated that to myself over and over. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. Even when I was terrified.
Well, you also say that sometimes you just let yourself get involved in the fear and became as scared as possible and then just kept walking.
That's right. Well, and so much of that, isn't that just how it is to be human? I mean, I think that the most important thing we can ever do, it has to do with acceptance. To say, you know, like in my grief, you know, what it was is I could not accept that the world now did not contain my mother. And when I reached the place that I could, that I said, she's dead. And even though I don't like it, I accept it. And I saw that I could bear it. And that had everything to do in literal ways, which is things like that ridiculously heavy backpack I was carrying. You know, I found that I could bear it even though it hurt to do so.
On the trip, you found some great people. And it seems that the only really bad experience you had involved one elderly couple who chased you away from a campsite because you didn't have the money to pay for it. And I was reading that. Of course, part of me was going, yeah, they're probably the only Republicans you found. But but I was thinking, what crass, horrible people. But they're the only ones.
That's right. I mean, and what was crazy is it was one of these campgrounds where, I mean, there was nobody else camped there. You know, I wasn't doing any harm. All I had was my big backpack and my little tent. And they would not let me stay there. And they made me pack up my bag, my pack, and hike away into the darkness because I didn't have like the $12 or $7 or whatever it was.
Or otherwise they were going to call the police.
They were going to call the police.
Unbelievable.
Well, they took their jobs. They were the campground, you know, supervisors or monitors, and they took their job rather too seriously, I think.
Well, that's one way to put it, because everybody else bent a little bit for you. Everyone else.
Everyone.
Bent.
And that was, I mean, that was the striking experience, is how kind and how generous others were to me. And I think that that's also the flip side of being, I mean, of being a woman alone. You know, we think of women alone as prey, but the flip side of that is people see women alone as vulnerable, and so they want to help them. They want to be kind to them. And I found that people really did that with me. Later in Oregon, I did come across a couple of men who were a little menacing, but it all ended okay. You know, I feel very fortunate. I think that one of the things is, you know, the world does open itself up to you if you're open to it. And it's really hard to be out in the wilderness and be mean to someone. You know, usually you meet other people and they're kindred spirits, regardless of politics or culture, any of that stuff. I mean, people really, you know, cross those lines.
Cheryl Strayed, which memory surprised you the most when you were working on this? Which one came up and you went, oh, my God. I'd forgotten completely about that. Wow.
Gosh, that's a hard question. It was something I always remembered. But I guess what surprised me the most when I was actually writing about it in the book, there's this moment where I'm lying in this bathtub. I've, you know, been in the wilderness for several weeks, and I'm taking this hot bath, and it just feels so unspeakably good. And I'm lying there, and I remember something my mother always told me and my siblings, and that is when we were born, she would kiss our every finger and every toe, and she would count our every eyelash. And I remember that at that moment when I felt so alone and so sort of beaten down physically. And so to be right in that scene and to have that memory of my mother, of her, you know, physical love, kissing me before I could even remember it, it felt really powerful to me that it emerged from my psyche at that moment.
When those things happen, how do you relate to your kids? I mean, do you suddenly go, oh, my God, I have my own kids at that point?
Yes. Well, yes, I have a 6-year-old and a 7-year-old. The love that my mother gave me lives in me in the love I give them, you know? And when I became a mother, that was another layer. Earlier you had asked me, will you ever write, you know, are you going to write more about your mom? That's what came to mind, is I haven't really written about what it means to be a mother and motherless, because there are so many things I've realized about my own mother now that I'm a mother. First of all, how much sacrifice is involved? I had no idea how well she loved me, even though she really had very little support and resources, but she did such a great job. And so with my own kids, I feel it very palpably, that love.
Obviously, when you're writing a book like this, I mean, it happens in fiction and nonfiction, insights about yourself arise. Were there any insights that came up about you or about your relationship with other people that you actually hadn't thought about for those 17 years that suddenly rose to the surface and you're going, wow, like that?
Yeah, I think that so much of the metaphorical aspects of the story, if you will. So this idea that, you know, that really heavy backpack being such a powerful metaphor for, you know, what I couldn't bear and having to figure out how to bear a weight I couldn't bear. Or the trail itself, you know, which is so much a metaphor for life, that the way that we thrive is simply to keep walking. And those were the things, that's what I very literally had to do on the trail. And so when I started writing, I mean, I must say, when I had the experience of hiking the trail, like I knew that this was, it felt transformative, it felt spiritually important, but it also felt physically difficult and monotonous and, you know, all of these other things. And so it wasn't as if I finished my hike and then was walking around saying, wow, you know, that heavy backpack, it really echoed what was going on for me emotionally, you know. But it was when I wrote the book that those things came to me. And those were profound. Like, I learned so much about my hike by writing the book about my hike. Because what I had to do is the writer's work of, you know, deeply and ruthlessly examining the self. And so I got to really look at the 26-year-old me in a way that I hadn't before.
So in other words, if this were a dream and you were analyzing the dream, you'd see the heavy backpack, the hurting feet, and you'd be able to suddenly connect it up as a dream metaphor to what was really going on with you.
Yes, absolutely. I think that this can be really powerfully psychologically, is to, you know, to place your own story within the context of the ancient sort of mythic stories. And, you know, in a lot of ways, this story I tell in Wild is a classic journey tale. The hero who goes into the darkness, goes out to sea, slays the dragons, does those things, and then returns changed and better.
At what point did you realize that that was the tale, or did you not realize it till you'd finished the book?
I don't think I realized it till I finished the book. I wrote the book in a blaze, very much right from my heart and my mind, from my body, really. And then when I stood back and looked at what I'd done, I could put it in that larger context. I think if I had sat down and, you know, said, I'm going to tell a classic tale that echoes these myths, it would have been a failure.
How connected do you feel today, Cheryl Strayed, with the Cheryl Strayed who just changed her name a few years earlier and was out in the wilderness? How connected do you feel now to that person?
You know, I feel connected to her. I feel like that young woman is me, but I also shake my head a lot, and maybe everyone does that. You know, I'm 43 now. I'm looking back at that 25, 26-year-old self and even younger, and, you know, I absolutely blush sometimes to think about, you know, my youthful arrogance, my self-absorption, my idiocy, you know, all of the silly things one does in the course of growing up.
Do you think that if you, at that age, had discovered a book, Wild, and picked it up instead of going on the trail, you would have been able to read it, or you would have thrown it across the room?
Interesting. What a great question. I mean, it's so hard to say. What a meta question. There's no right answer, right? If I say, oh, I would have loved it, it sounds ridiculous. But, you know, I think that I was always interested in writers who were able to risk, you know, their hearts on the page. I've always been drawn to that. And so I probably would have devoured it.
Cheryl Strayed, the people on the trail, I want to ask you a little about what happened to them. One of them I know passed away a couple of years later, Doug,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
Was that his real name?
Yes.
But there's also the three young bucks.
Did I stay in touch with the three young bucks? I did. The one I wrote about, there's one of the three young bucks who I sort of had a crush on, and he had a crush on me. And I wrote about him, and he, you know, has been my friend over the years. We stayed in touch and were friends. He came to my wedding, and, you know, he actually lives in California, in Davis. The funny thing that happened, you know, I'm writing about meeting these guys on the trail, and I'm writing about how I have this crush on him, which I never told him about. And he never, you know, told me how he felt. So I'm writing this scene, and I'm saying in Wild, like, okay, I think that he has a crush on me, too.
Well, you kind of went back to the tent together at one point, I think.
There is a scene where we're lying next to each other
yeah.
in the back of a pickup truck.
Yeah. Oh,
and
yeah,
I'm saying, you know, I want to kiss him, but I'm not going to do it. For once in my life, I'm not going to do this. So what was embarrassing is I realized, okay, I don't want Wild to come out. And then my friend Rick reads this book and says, Cheryl, you're mistaken. I never had a crush on you. So all these years later, I said, Rick, would you just read this scene? You know, did you have a crush on me back in, you know, 95 when we met on the trail? And it was really funny because he emailed me back and he said, absolutely. And so we got to process this unexpressed crush. My husband was entertained or not so.
And the father and son?
The father and son, I have not been in touch with, no.
Greg.
You know, he's somebody who I couldn't find because that's a fake name. So for people who I couldn't track down, I gave them different names. And for people who I could track down, I said, I'm writing this book. Would you like me to use your real name or change the name? And some people said change and some people said real. But yeah, Greg, he was this important person to me at this moment of the hike, but he has a common enough name that I couldn't find him on the internet.
And the couple.
I communicated with them. Yep.
Has your ex-husband read the book?
He's reading it right now.
Well, he comes across very well.
Yeah.
He has nothing to be embarrassed about.
That's right. I wrote with a lot of love about him. And, you know, we've had our own journey that's, you know, not chronicled in the book and, you know, have come to peace with each other and we wish each other well.
He's remarried.
He is.
The guy in Portland who you called Joe, what happened to him?
He spent several years really as a heroin addict. I know that at one point he did get clean. He went into rehab and really did get clean. And it's been several years since I've talked to him. But when we last talked, he was really on the right track and engaged to be married. And I have not been able to track him down, but I'm hoping for the best for him.
Cheryl Strayed, you make an interesting comment in a brief interview that was in The New Yorker. In Wild and Torch, my conceit is that the readers are there and not there. In the Dear Sugar columns, the conceit is the opposite. I have a message to deliver. What do you mean by the readers are there and not there?
Well, in Dear Sugar, what I'm doing, you know, somebody has written me a letter, we published the letter, and I'm replying to that letter. And so even though my response, you know, I attempt to really include the larger audience of readers, they certainly feel included, I think, when they read it, but I'm writing a letter to a very specific person. There's a direct address, which has been such a fascinating thing to me as a writer because it allows me, I guess, to be just more overt about the fact that I am writing this letter to you. Whereas in Wild, you know, and Torch, I don't ever turn around to the reader. And I know a lot of meta literature does this and looks at the reader and says, so you out there, you're probably thinking this or that in this moment. So it's just a more implicit. As a writer, I know the reader's there, but I'm not going to violate that sort of screen that exists between us.
Well, when you're writing a book like Wild or your novel, are you thinking about somebody out there reading it, a particular individual? For this book, I could see you're thinking, for instance, my ex-husband will be reading this book at some point.
Oh, yeah. I mean, certainly when writing a memoir, that is, I would say, the most difficult aspect is, you know, knowing that you're writing about people in your life, you know, some who are just acquaintances, like some of those people I met on the trail, others who are, you know, very close to me. And it's a very uncomfortable experience because you do have to write the truth about your life while also not violating anyone else's privacy or hurting their feelings. And, you know, there's a whole lot more I could have said about many, many of the people I wrote about in Wild and chose not to because I didn't want to hurt their feelings or violate their privacy.
Well, in the case of your brother and your sister, I could see the anger, but you try to tamp it down a little bit, but it's there.
Right. Well, you know, it's not there anymore. I've certainly come out the other side and understood that people grieve differently, and I have no anger really for anyone I wrote about in Wild. And what you're referring to is when my mother got sick, they just really weren't there. And it took me years to understand that they couldn't be for whatever reason. And, you know, like I said, I've let that go. But I gave my brother a copy of Wild before it came out several months ago. And, you know, I knew that it would be difficult for him to read because, you know, he's in some of the most difficult scenes in the book. And he read it. He loved it. And not only that, we had the most profound conversation of our lives. And it was Wild that opened that up. It was the first time he said that he saw that I had also lost my mom. You know, I'm his big sister, and I always had this maternal role with him. And he could see me as like a separate person from him. And it was the first time he said to me, you know, I'm so sorry that I wasn't there for you. I'm sorry I wasn't there for you, which was really powerful to me. And I got to say, look, I don't hold anything against you. You know, we're all forgiven. You know, I think a lot of times people think memoir will rip your family apart. But actually, in some ways, it brought us more deeply back together.
Cheryl Strayed, I understand that Monster the Backpack still is around and it sits in your basement.
It does. It does. It's a great backpack.
Have you used it since?
I have. My husband and I have hiked for about a month on the Continental Divide Trail in New Mexico and also gone on several backpacking trips in other places. But since we had kids, we don't get to go backpacking much anymore. We go hiking, but not backpacking.
So after this, one thing that you don't talk about is, instead of being someone who never went out backpacking, you became a backpacking fanatic or fan, or at least?
Yeah, certainly a fan. Well, that's what's interesting is, seriously, by the end of my backpacking trip, I was an expert. You know, I began a novice. But, you know, the trail teaches you, if you're out there for 94 days carrying a backpack, you learn how to backpack. You know, in my next trips, I backpacked much. I knew I was went out there much more prepared.
If you were able to give advice to the Cheryl of 25 years old about backpacking on the trail, what advice would you give now other than find better boots?
Find better boots. Don't take so much stuff. I really didn't take the warnings about weight very seriously. I know it sounds ridiculous. I shake my head, you know, looking back at the more dunderheaded me. But, you know, I just thought, okay, you need this, you need that, you need the other thing. You put it all in a bag and lift it up. I didn't really think very much about what all of that would weigh together. And the other thing is, you know, it's so different now. This trail that I'm writing about, 1995, in some ways it's a different trail because of the internet. I tried to research the trail, but there wasn't a whole lot of material out there. And, you know, now you can, you know, log in online and just you could find just so many resources and people's trail journals and, you know, endless stories about the PCT. And if I had had that, I probably would have gone out there with less stuff.
The other thing, of course, is that today two major changes which would have affected you then. One is you would have had a cell phone, which meant in case of emergency, you running out of money, you could have called your friend in Portland and said, you know, put something in an ATM, which you didn't have either at the time.
That's right.
You know, an ATM card. The other, of course, is that instead of having the music in your head, you could have easily just simply brought an iPod.
Yes, and the hikers I talk to now, they are walking on the trail with iPods. They're listening to digital books, music. They are downloading, you know, their email on the trail. Last summer, I was hiking on the PCT in Oregon with my iPhone, and I tweeted from the trail. I checked my email. It's a really different thing. And that is one thing, too, is I encourage people, you know, to go with the silence. You know, I understand how tempting technology is. I really do, because I myself, I must admit, I would take my iPhone out there and I would take some headphones. But I will say that what I learned and what I was given so profoundly had everything to do with silence and with the fact that I had to occupy myself. I had to let my mind do what it did when left to its own devices.
And also that you had to be alone with no other resources.
That's
right. I
mean,
when you were out of water, you could have used your iPhone and GPS, found out where you were. Instead of looking around or having a crappy map that you couldn't quite read, you would have known where you were, where the water was, where someone else was. and you wouldn't have been stepping outside the world as you did.
That's right. That's right. If things had turned out badly, I would say, yeah, take all those, take that technology. But of course, you know, like I said, you know, if things turn out well, you know, there's a tremendous amount you learn from having to rely on yourself.
Well, you also would not have read James Michener because your Kindle would have had other books in it.
That's right. That's right.
There's a lot of things that change. I mean, a lot of serendipity that was experienced 10 or 15 years ago. I mean, if I was out of a book and in a motel somewhere, you read the first thing you run across, you don't have something with you. A lot of that has changed. I'm not sure if it's changed for the better.
I don't think it has. I mean, there's this moment in Wild where something happens to me and I say, okay, I only have two choices, and they're to go forward and back, and they're the same choice. Either way, I'm just walking through the wilderness. And I think the downside of technology is that we've been given too many choices. Like you said, you know, I too, the moment you said, hey, if you're out of a book and you're in some motel, then you come across this paperback and you end up reading it. And some of the best books that I've found, I found that way, and I would not have chosen them. And so if you're sitting there with your little electronic book and you can go on and choose the book you want to read, you're never going to find the book you don't think you want to read. You know, one of the things we haven't gotten into talking about yet, but on the trail, I sent myself a book in each resupply box. You know, before I set out on my trip, I just sort of grabbed, you know, like 10 books or so that I'd really wanted to read and plopped them one in each box. And so they ended up being these important things to me. But even those books in some ways were sort of serendipitous. You know, they were one among many that I wanted to read.
And so you just threw a book in, and there was one package, I think, where you forgot to throw in money. I mean, that sort of thing.
Right. Yeah. Well, in each box, there was a $20 bill, and in one, there was not. So I had no money. Yeah, that was not fun.
Cheryl Strayed, what is VITA?
VITA is Women in Literary Arts. It's a nonprofit organization that I helped found a few years ago with other women writers. And what we decided to do is, so many of us had been in conversations among ourselves, been talking about how we sort of felt like, you know, there were so many women writers, and many of us are teachers, and our classes are full of women. So there's not a dearth of women writing today. But what we kept seeing over and over again is that women weren't really appearing in numbers on the pages of our most prestigious journals and magazines, and being reviewed to the same extent. Our first thought was really, are we just being paranoid, or is this actually happening? And so what we decided to do is really come together and form an organization where we would do this thing we call the count, where we took a count of, you know, the New York Review of Books, the New York Times, the Washington Post, Harper's, the New Yorker, the Paris Review, Granta, magazines and journals such as that. And we just counted who they published in the course of a year and who they reviewed. And the numbers were absolutely shocking, worse than we imagined. And you can see them if you go to our website, vitaweb.org. We've put them in these pie charts. And so at a quick glance, you can see that we weren't just being crazy, that there really is some gender imbalance happening in favor of male authors. So, you know, we're not saying, okay, you know, everyone, it has to be 50-50, we're going to count beans, you know, and that's always the criticism. When anyone criticizes, you know, bias based on numbers, that's the answer. And we're not saying that. But we're saying, okay, there is something going on here when the numbers are looking like, you know, it's breaking down. It's like 10% women, 90% men in so many of our most prestigious venues. We know that women publish and write great books and read and all of those things. What we're saying is what VITA wants to do is further the conversation so that editors who we know have good intentions are really maybe thinking more deeply about how gender bias does play into some of their decisions about who they look at, who they review, who they publish. We've gotten a great response from so many editors. We've done a count again this year. The numbers were still ugly, but we're hoping that what we can do is maybe do enough work that 10 years down the road, those numbers are starting to look profoundly different.
Cheryl Strayed, any interest from Hollywood yet?
Yes. Reese Witherspoon's production company, Pacific Standard, has optioned Wild for film. Reese would like to play in it, starring me.
Cheryl Strayed, I understand you're working, as you said, on a new book, and this is about four women friends in Portland?
Yes. Well, you know, and it's hard to say I'm working on that book because I've been so busy promoting Wild and putting the finishing touches on Tiny Beautiful Things, which will be out in July. But I did begin a novel fairly recently, and I'm interested in seeing where that goes.
Dear Sugar can be found at therumpus.net, and it's an advice column that's a little bit more autobiography than advice, would you say?
Well, I think I do both. I don't write about the stories of my life in the Dear Sugar column so much to tell stories about my life, but rather to tell stories about my life that will, by way of advising the person who's written to me. Because I just think that so often, you know, that sort of lecturing mode doesn't work. It's the story mode. You know, I've learned the most important things myself through reading novels and poems and memoirs that told me a story that meant something to me, that resonated with me. And so I use that as a device to give advice.
And the more particularized you get, conversely, in a weird way, the more universal it becomes.
That is such a mystery to me. The first time I wrote a column in which I told a story from my life, I was really nervous because I feared that readers would say, well, why is she telling us about her? You know. But what happened is they did the opposite. They got it because they saw themselves in the story I was telling. I can't begin to tell you how many people have, you know, written to me. They respond so strongly when I tell stories from my life, and it isn't because it's about me. It's because it's about them.
You've been listening to an interview with Cheryl Strayed, whose memoir is titled Wild, From Lost to Found on the Pacific Crest Trail. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.